Be on your guard against all kinds of greed. One's life doesn't consist in the abundance of possessions. What he said about the sudden death of a man with a successful grain harvest. You fool. The worst insult at Jesus' time was to call somebody a fool, because that person was deprived of God's wisdom, of God's way of looking at things, at the perspective of the real world. You fool. So it is with those who store up for themselves treasure here on earth, but are not rich toward God. Jesus' clear teaching on more than one occasion about how we can't serve both God and mammon, giving us a clear choice that seems to be like a choice between Christ and Barabbas. Mary's words in her Magnificat, that God fills the hungry with good things but sends the rich away empty. Finally, St. Paul's words to St. Timothy, that the root of all evil is the love of money. These and other sayings, which were clearly a warning against the idolatry of money and material things, of placing our faith, hope, and love in the things of this world rather than in God, led to some treating those who sought to make money in business seem like worshippers of the ancient golden calf, a bias that could often find its ways into homilies and sermons, catechesis and Bible school lessons, and other fora. Through the term and the theme of the entrepreneurial vocation, Father Sirico and the Acton Institute wanted to focus on the fundamental goodness of the business endeavor, of the calling of the businessman, of the material dimension of human existence and the theology of work, arguing that the creative aspect of the entrepreneur was similar to God's creative activity that we see in the book of Genesis. Like the vocation of a parent procreating and raising children, so the entrepreneur, in a less sublime way, brings enterprises into birth and nurtures them to serve others' unmet needs, providing the opportunity for others to grow and support their family and help so many develop through fostering their own vocation of work. We're no longer in the same situation as Father Sirico and the Acton Institute encountered a quarter of a century ago, where business leaders are universally and univocally castigated. But many places, they've now gotten off the most wanted list and occasionally onto Santa's good side. This is partially, we can say, because of the perseverance and persuasiveness of Father Sirico in the Acton Institute over these last 26 years. I've been with them basically from the beginning, and I admire very much how much progress has been made because of the consistent teaching and preaching about the entrepreneurial vocation, the goodness of the business enterprise, and how it's not contrary to God's plans, but consistent. But there have been other factors too. For Catholics, at least, the change is clearly one of the implications of the Second Vatican Council universal call to holiness, that business leaders are likewise called to be holy, and as long as they're doing their work honestly and virtuously, it can make them holy. And the recent popes have likewise played a big role in that change. St. John Paul II spoke persuasively about the role of the entrepreneur. In an address to entrepreneurs in Milan in 1985, he promoted the value of entrepreneurship as a social service. He said, "The degree of well-being that society enjoys today would have been impossible without the dynamic figure of the entrepreneur, whose function consists in organizing human labor and the means of production in order to produce goods and services." But I just want to draw something out that's underneath the surface there. The degree of well-being that society enjoys today would have been impossible without the dynamic figure of the entrepreneur. That word dynamic he's using in a pneumatological way, in a way that's referring to the Holy Spirit. In Greek, power is dunamis, and it's often referred to as the third person of the Blessed Trinity. And he's describing that one of the manifestations of the common good, manifestations of the Spirit for the common good that we'll see in 1 Corinthians 12, is precisely this entrepreneurial charism, which is not to make the entrepreneur rich, but like all charisms, is a gift given for others, precisely to help others and to grow society. Pope Benedict authorized the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace to put out a beautiful document in May 2012 entitled The Vocation of the Business Leader, in which it forthrightly stated, "The vocation of the business person is a genuine Christian calling. It's important, importance in the life of the church and in the world economy can hardly be overstated." Pope Benedict would likewise talk about the vocation of every Christian toward integral development in his 2007 encyclical Caritas in Veritate, Charity and Truth, in which he would say that by our own innovation, by our own initiative, we've been tasked by God with not merely developing ourselves, but developing the world around us, something that traces back to Genesis, as we'll have a chance to explore more. Pope Francis called business a noble vocation in Evangelii Gaudium 203. Then he repeated that same phrase, that business is a noble vocation, in Laudato Si' 29. Then when he came to the United States last September before Congress, he acknowledged how important the entrepreneurial vocation is in the fight of poverty, against poverty, excuse me. He said there before the representatives and senators in Washington, "The fight against poverty and hunger must be fought constantly and on many fronts, especially in its causes. I know that many Americans today, as in the past, are working to deal with this problem. It goes without saying that part of this great effort involves the creation and the distribution of wealth. The right use of natural resources, the proper application of technology, and the harnessing of the spirit of enterprise are essential elements of an economy that seeks to be modern, inclusive, and sustainable." And then he repeated those words that he had already said twice before. Business is a noble vocation directed to producing wealth and improving the world. It can be a fruitful source of prosperity for the era in which it operates, especially if it sees the creation of jobs as an essential part of its service to the common good. But I go at length through those words of Pope Francis. Many think Pope Francis is opposed to the entrepreneurial vocation, to the good of business. He's absolutely not. What he's opposed to is what he thinks is a deification of the market and an obsession with profit above every other factor. But the words I've just read are not the words of somebody who disparages business or business people. In fact, in his message to the World Economic Forum in Davos a couple years back, he showed his high appreciation for the work of entrepreneurs in development, writing about the fundamental role that the modern business activity has had in bringing about positive changes by stimulating and developing the immense resources of human intelligence. So while the title of the entrepreneurial vocation is no longer quasi-blasphemous or controversial, that doesn't mean it's well or deeply understood. And so this morning what I'd like to do in this talk is to understand the call of the entrepreneur more profoundly from a theological and a practical level, with the hope of essentially doing three things: nourishing the understanding of those engaged in business so that they might live out their vocation more ardently together with God; help those in ministry or future ministry support better those in business and strengthen those in business to live out their vocations to the full; and help all of us to see, third, that there's supposed to be an entrepreneurial dimension to every Christian vocation, that some of the traits of the entrepreneur are supposed to describe whatever we're doing. My work as a priest, so many people's work, teaching, the work of parents, all noble human activity. So we're going to go in stages to build up to the entrepreneurial vocation. And there are two steps before we can really tackle it appropriately. The first step is what a vocation is. Vocation is a calling from God, not just to anything at all. The ultimate root of every vocation is it's a means by God, a summons by Him, to become holy as He is holy in the midst of doing something and being someone. Often we think about the word calling in the specific context of the calling of the apostles from their boats or their money tables, or Saul from being a persecutor to a propagator of Christians. In other words, we can think that it has to do with preaching the gospel primarily, leaving behind family, lands, occupations for the kingdom. These are real vocations, but they're not the only ones. The fundamental vocation every Christian has received through baptism is the vocation to be like God, to be holy as He is holy, to be teleos is the Greek word, fit for purpose. We call it perfect, but I don't like the translation because it creates neurotic perfectionists. But to be teleos, to be apt, to be who we're supposed to be, just as God is perfect, to be merciful as a father is merciful. St. Paul wrote to the Thessalonians, "This is God's will for you, your sanctification." Holiness is becoming more and more godlike. It involves a progressive, graced appropriation of divine attributes, so that the deepest source of who we are, namely our capacity to image God and to be configured to Christ by the power of the Holy Spirit, is made manifest. We've all received that vocation, no matter what way that God asks us to live it out, what profession He's given us, what particular activities we do. How is this vocation of holiness achieved? For the vast majority of people, it's achieved in the middle of the world. Doing what? Precisely doing work. In the words of St. John Paul II, holiness is not something outside the bounds of normal everyday life. For God calls His people to live holy lives within the ordinary circumstances in which they find themselves, at home, in their parish, in the workplace, at school, on the playing field. Wherever we are, that is the locus sanctitatis, is what he's saying, the place in which we can grow in holiness. Each of us has received a vocation to work. The first command in the Bible, which we'll be developing much more below, was not what we call the first commandment of the Decalogue, but came right after God called us into existence. Be fruitful and multiply. Fill the earth and subdue it. Have dominion over all the creatures. That triple imperative was how God wants us to work out our having been created in His image and likeness. John Paul II commented in his document on human work, Laborum Exercens, that we must go back to the fundamental issue of human work, which is of such importance for the human person. It constitutes one of the fundamental dimensions of his earthly existence and his vocation. And he would say in Centissimus Annus, work belongs to the vocation of every person. Indeed, the human person expresses and fulfills himself through working. He expresses and fulfills himself through working. But that doesn't mean work alienated from God. St. John Paul II had spent his upbringing in communist Poland, in which there was that problem of alienation. And he confronted it not with Marxism, but with the gospel, by calling people precisely through their work to allow it to unite themselves to God in His continued working, as Jesus would say. The Father is working always and I am working still. It expresses and fulfills himself through working. There's a lot packed into that sentence. When John Paul II was in his mid-40s, he participated in the Second Vatican Council. And he really had an influence on two of the documents, the document on religious freedom as well as the document on the church in the modern world, which is called Gaudium Spes. And in it fought very hard for two phrases to be put in, which he then spent his entire pontificate developing. First phrase was in the 22nd paragraph of Gaudium Spes, which said, God fully, in Christ, God fully reveals himself to man and makes his supreme vocation clear. Which is a theological point, that if we want to know who the human person is, we need to look to Christ, who is perfect man. But then second was a moral point that flowed from it. Man cannot find himself except in the disinterested gift of the unselfish gift of himself to others. So from that theological point, that in order to understand who we are, we must look to Jesus Christ, flows a moral point, that to be like Christ, we learn to love as Christ loves, and Christ defines love as laying down his life for others. No one has greater love than to sacrifice himself for others. And man fully finds himself in this unselfish gift of himself for others, which is what he does through work. Work is a means by which we're able to love, regardless of the type of work that is done, as long as it's honest. The work of a mother, the work of a dad leaving very early, that is a means by which we're able to express love. I didn't capture this when I was a little kid, as most don't, but there was something that always fascinated me when I was a boy. My parents wanted my twin brother and me to practice the piano, but we wanted to play sports. So the only way we could work both out was if we got up really early in the morning to practice the piano. So I would get up at 3:45 in the morning from the time I was 3 to the time I was 14 to practice for 45 minutes. And my twin brother would get up, and then my younger brother and sister would get up. And then we'd take out the clarinets and the saxophones and we'd really make a ruckus. Thanks be to God, the owners of the duplex on the other side were both deaf prior to hearing me. But my dad would leave every day at 4:15 to drive almost 75 miles up from Lowell, Massachusetts to Portsmouth, New Hampshire, where he worked in a job for 25 years in which his bosses were constantly riding and he didn't like it, but he never called in sick. And sometimes he would come back really stressed from that workplace. But over the course of time, I began to grasp that this was the way my dad said, I love you. Still to this day, whenever my mom writes me letters and she does all the X's and the O's at the end of the letter, my dad only just says, me too, dad. Doesn't really express verbally, but in the language of the body, he was constantly working. And one of the great, greatest experiences of my life, frankly, was when my twin brother and I graduated from Harvard back in 1992. We were the first members of our family ever to go to college. And my dad's younger brother came up from Missouri, and he always thought that my dad was the stupid one in the family. And he couldn't figure out how Roger, my dad, could have two boys go to Harvard. And he was boisterously sort of mocking my dad. And Scott and I, who were both athletes, wrestlers at times, tennis players, basketball players, and the rest, looked at each other with those eyes, you got this or do I? And I said, I have it. So I went up to the microphone and I took it and I said, sometimes people ask, how is it that Roger and Mitch Landry had their eldest go to Harvard? And there my Uncle Dick is there yelling, yeah, we all have that question. I said, well, let me answer that question. And I told how my earliest memories of seeing my dad leave every day with his lunchbox, come back tired. And he never once called in sick. And I said, it's curious that Scott and I, from kindergarten until today, have never missed one day of school. We didn't realize that God had blessed us with any particular intelligence
All that we were trying to do is work as hard in our study as we saw my dad work for us. Work is a means of expressing love. And that's what John Paul II is saying about works fulfilling ourselves. We're fulfilled only in love. Christ came and did the work for us in our salvation and turned to us with calloused and pierced but no longer bleeding hands, saying, "Come follow me." And he saved us not just by his 3 years of public ministry. He saved us not just by the 3 days of the sacred Triduum. He saved us by his entire life, 90% of which was spent hidden in an apprenticeship in a carpenter shop. When we look at the book of Genesis, we see some of the essential aspects of the vocation to work, which is at the foundation of the vocation of the entrepreneur. God said, "Be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it, have dominion over the fish of the sea, the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves upon the earth." This first command, which was before the fall, was a command to live in the image of God the Creator in a twofold way. First, by sharing in the gift of procreating with the Creator new human life, referring to a specific type of human activity. And secondly, through work, filling the earth and subduing it and having dominion over all living creatures. All of us have received this vocation to cooperate, to work with the Creator, and subduing the gift of the earth he's created for us and having dominion, sharing in his work as dominus, as a good steward. We are the image of God partly through the mandate we've received from God to do precisely this. And in carrying out this mandate to work, every human being reflects to some degree the very action of the Creator of the universe. And it's through this type of work that we distinguish ourselves from other creatures. After the fall, this vocation remained, but now would be accomplished, as Genesis tells us, with the sweat of the brow. But that toil is redemptive. Sweat and toil, which necessarily involves our present condition, presents Christians and everyone who is called with the possibility of sharing lovingly in the work Christ came to do. It's no longer merely in a participation in God's creative work, but it becomes a participation in God's redemptive work. And that toil, which makes it so much more difficult, is in a sense a penance through which we work precisely in order to be restored in our capacity to love. Work, as St. John Paul II wrote in Laborum Exercens, transforms both the world and the worker. There's a transitive quality in which we change something, and an intransitive in which we are transformed. Pope Benedict in Caritas in Veritate talked about these two dimensions of work when he wrote about technology. The technology enables us to exercise dominion over matter, to improve our conditions of life. It touches the heart of the vocation of human work. In technology, seen as the product of his genius, man recognizes himself and forges his humanity. Technology is the objective side of human action, whose origin and reason of being is found precisely in the subjective element, the worker himself. For this reason, technology is never merely technology. It reveals man and his aspirations toward development. It expresses the inner tension that impels him gradually to overcome material limitations. Technology, in this sense, is a response to God's command to till and keep the land that he's entrusted to humanity and must serve to reinforce the covenant between human beings and the environment, a covenant that should mirror God's creative love. We see both dimensions in technology, because we see them in work. First, we make something, and in the process of making something, we reform ourselves with the help of God's grace. Work is a transitive activity, changes creation. We can draw computer chips out of sand. We can draw medicines out of plants. We change the visible world. St. Augustine in the early church said that creation was finished on the sixth day. But it was finished in the sense that there were a lot of seeds planted in creation that needed to be watered, that needed to be cultivated, that needed to be allowed to grow over the course of time. It wasn't complete in the sense that everything was already at a stage of perfection. God completed creation but left things there to grow, like we grow over the course of our life. And one of the most important ways we grow in His image and likeness, as He's going to say, through the intransitive work that happens through human labor. As a person, man is, John Paul II said, the subject of work. And independent of the objective content of what he does, his actions serve to realize his humanity. If I make this podium and I make it well, I'm likewise sculpting myself. If I do a shoddy job in making this podium, I am likewise deforming myself. This is why St. Gregory of Nyssa, one of the Cappadocian fathers in the 4th century in Turkey, said that we are the parents of ourselves through our work. That we give birth to our character, in a sense, by the virtues or the lack thereof we take to our activity. There is this intransitive focus. And in English, what's curious and a little... It's important for us to note this linguistically. In many of the Romance languages, there are different words to do. So, for example, in Latin, from which they all ultimately derive, there's facere and there's agere. Facere is to make something. Agere is focused on the work of the agent. In Portuguese, it's fazer and actuar. In Spanish, it's hacer and agir. Or actuar, I think, also in Spanish. Agire, also in Italian, versus fare. But in all of these languages, there's a distinction between what we make and who we form. And we can look at work under both of those dimensions. And for us to get the fullest sense of the work we're doing, we must look at it under both dimensions. One of the impoverishments of our English language is, and one of the things that some of the times can lead to an alienation in work, is we focus with just the one term fundamentally on what we produce rather than on the changes that occur within us through that activity. And this brings us to an important point about enterprise, which we'll pick up again later. There's a need for a spirituality of work that will help all people come closer through work to God, the Creator and Redeemer, to participate in His salvific work, saving man in the world, and precisely through work, deepening their friendship with Christ the worker. And this emphasis on the importance of work for the worker gives rise to a particularly Christian conception of the business enterprise that's radically different from a conception of a business as a mere engine for profit. The purpose of a business firm within a Christian perspective is not simply to make a profit, but to form a community of persons that can satisfy their basic needs through work and contribute thereby to the well-being of society. And at a practical level, where does this become very relevant today? In the debate over technology that can make so much of production far more efficient, but a lot of the times can lay lots of people off.
There are the technological innovations that clearly allow us to do things that we've never been able to do before, maybe do it better. So much of the computer innovations allow us to do so much more. But there always needs to be that question in conscience, even though I might be able to do it faster, even though I might be able to increase a profit margin, what type of human cost is that going to have? Because one of the responsibilities of a Christian entrepreneur is to form that community of workers so that they're able precisely to develop who they are. All the popes, but particularly Pope Francis, has focused a lot on the problem of unemployment and how unemployment can be so dehumanizing. If we're made for work and we're not working, we're lost. When I was preparing to be a priest in the seminary, I never was formed for it nor anticipated that I would have one of the issues I had working in inner city parishes in Fall River and New Bedford, Massachusetts for over a decade as a pastor, where so many of my parishioners had been totally deformed by certain aspects of dependence to the welfare state. I never thought that I'd be preaching about the fact that, listen, if you hurt your knee and you could no longer do manual labor, that doesn't mean at 38 you retire. There's plenty of other work that can be done. But a lot of the times there was a mentality there that, okay, too bad that I'm going to have to limp a little bit, but it's good that I can basically take a perpetual Sabbath until the Lord takes me to the eternal Sabbath. I needed to mention that, and what really struck me was I had a 22-year-old boy who used to supervise the altar servers. He had gone on to college off and on. He hadn't finished. But he was working in one of these factories in Fall River. And he had a little bit of an injury on the jaw. A little bit of an injury. His hand was injured. And he came back because this was the third generation of collectors and just said, you know, I'm hoping I'm going to be able to get disability for the rest of my life. And I turned to him and said, please don't say that. No, you won't, because you would be displeasing God very much and you would be robbing yourself of the type of development God wants to give you. How important work is. And when we're not working, both in terms of our actual employment as well as how we use our free time, whether we're using it just for entertainment or for things that make us indolent, or we're using that free time as a gift to be able to be given to others in one form or another, that is the hinge on the basis of whether we grow in virtue or we don't. All of this leads to what John Paul II called the gospel of work. The description of creation we find in the very first chapter of the book of Genesis is, he says, the first gospel of work. Man ought to imitate God as creator in working and in resting, he said, because man alone has the unique characteristic of likeness to God. By means of his work, man participates in the activity of God himself as creator, which was given particular prominence by Jesus. And then he describes the gospel of work we see in that carpenter shop in Nazareth, which is why I have that as the image for the outline here. Jesus Christ entered into our work precisely to redeem it and to show us that if he could do it, it's a path of holiness for us as well, because obviously he would never do anything evil. Jesus likewise is always talking about work. Just a quick little scan. He refers to the work of the shepherd, the farmer, the doctor, the sower, the householder, the servant, the steward, the fisherman, the merchant, and the laborer. He speaks about various forms of women's work. He compares the apostolate, the work of the kingdom, to the harvesters and to the fishermen. He likewise refers to the work of scholars too, but most of the time not in a good way. And we won't even say what he says about the ancient lawyers. What's the specific vocation of the entrepreneur? This phrase doesn't merely refer to those who found startups.
But to those who have responsibility for the creation of wealth or for its growth in business. The theology of the business vocation, like any vocational theology, needs a vision so that people can be helped to identify the deeper meaning of what someone is doing, so that he or she can begin to see the sacred in it, to see its potential realization in their day-to-day work life. What would be the elements of the vocation of an entrepreneur? For this, there are lots of ways that we could do it, but I think it's helpful for us to turn to what the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace gave us in 2012 in the vocation of the business leader. They said, entrepreneurship is a vocation of holiness marked by acceptance of risk from human realities, some of which cannot be controlled, and some, like human freedom, that ought not to be controlled. So there's a great risk-taking here in which you're not in charge. And in some areas, you're not supposed to be in charge. Let's just pause there for a second. Remind us of a little bit of the way God created, in which there was one thing he didn't put himself in charge of. By his own divine will, he made us free. He can't control us. And there's a participation in God's creative, but also in, we could say, God's humble respect for other subjectivity. And in business, obviously, there's plenty of subjectivity, whether somebody's ever going to buy a product you make. Second, is persistence in the offering of beneficial goods and services to others. To make it in business, you often fail many times first. You have a lot of ideas. Maybe only one works, but some of the times that's all that you need. And it's persistence not just in doing anything. It's in offering beneficial goods and services to others. You see a need out there that isn't being met at all, or that isn't being met well, or isn't being met enough, and that's where you try to involve yourself so that that need gets met. Third, creative planning to combine the resources of self and others. So we participate in God's creativity with the gift of reason and will that he's given us, but we do something not just really on our own. We involve others in this whole enterprise. First, our collaborators. And if we're really going to succeed, we're going to invest in them a lot. But also in those who will purchase what we make, those who will help us in advertise it, for example, etc. That it's creative work that's done together with others, in which we combine our resources and talents and life stories sometimes and experiences together with that of many others in order collectively to meet one of these unmet needs. And then the fourth criterion it describes is adaptation in the face of initial failures. That there's constant feedback coming and we're constantly tinkering. In pursuing this vocation, the entrepreneur at his or her best embarks on a life that involves the surrender of control as well as the surrender of all that's provisional and unnecessary. You know, the church as a whole has a lot to learn from the way business people approach the bottom line. Jesus talks about this in the Sermon on the Mount when he says, if your eye is causing you to sin, pluck it out and toss it. Better for you to go into the fires of Gehenna with one eye than with both. Sorry, better for you to enter into life with one eye than for you to, with both, to be tossed into the fires. Likewise with your hand, likewise with your foot. At a business level, any businesses that are successful, if they know one division is hemorrhaging them money, they cut it off in order to be able to save the business. And Jesus wants us, in a sense, to have the same perspective.
For Catholics, one of the things I say all the time is with regard to our examination of conscience. You know, if a businessman only went over his accounts payable and receivable once a year, or once every 4 or 5 years, that business wouldn't stand much of a chance. Most of the times they're doing the accounting every day or every week. Is our soul more important than our business, or vice versa? Do we take that same regular examination of the most important enterprise God has given us of all as seriously as successful business people have taken their business enterprises? So let's flesh out a few of these elements. Entrepreneurs share in a special way in the work of the Creator, bringing out the fullest potential to what God has given us. They play a great role in the unfolding of creation. And business is a productive organization that organizes itself precisely to unfold the Lord's great gift. They share, in a sense, in God's providence, seeing ahead, providere is what that word means, looking to what's needed, envisioning the possibility of a good or service that's innovative. The entrepreneur anticipates others' future needs sometimes and takes risks based on what he thinks will be the response of others. Entrepreneur, in a sense, intends to create part of the future, while at the same time recognizing that success and failure will be determined by others who are free to accept or reject the offer made to the entrepreneur. Entrepreneurs are called to be good stewards of material possessions, of themselves, and of other persons. And we see how that flows from our calling. St. Bernardine of Siena in the 15th century, a great Franciscan preacher, at a time when the mercantile class was growing very quickly in Italy, recognized 4 gifts in the entrepreneur, even going back 600 years ago. Efficiency, that they don't waste. What a beautiful quality this is for every Christian. Responsibility, that we recognize that we're accountable to the Lord. Hard work, the word in Latin that he would use is diligence, which comes from love. Precisely through our work, we are loving and risk-taking, in which they act on Jesus' words in the gospel 27 times. Be not afraid. The entrepreneur takes these gifts and combines them with insight about something people need, works very hard to fill that need in a creative and productive way. The business leader is essentially an innovator, not a speculator. The building of roads or establishing schools or hospitals isn't the goal, but merely a means to the goal of maximum profit for a speculator. For an innovator, it's making all things new because it's meant precisely to serve others. And the successful entrepreneur over time is one who focuses acutely, even we could say obsessively, on others' needs. There are several scriptural passages that talk about entrepreneurialism or about the good that is done by those with wealth as models. We've got Zacchaeus, who gave half his possessions to the poor and repaid fourfold any fraud. Joseph of Arimathea, who was able, because of what he had earned, to give Christ a tomb. The parable of the Good Samaritan. In January, Cardinal George Pell, whom Pope Francis had brought to reform the Vatican finances, gave an interview with the Financial Times in which he talked about the Good Samaritan.
And he said something that really struck me. I've never quite heard it that way. But he said, if the Good Samaritan had been without capital, he couldn't have paid for the cure of the man who was beaten and robbed on the road to Jericho. They'd asked him, you know, are you the most important guy at Pope Francis' right side? He said, no, I'm just managing the money. I'm not the most important, but we can't do anything else unless there's me. There's very little that can be done without this provision. The Good Samaritan shows us that there's a starting point to charity. In order to be able to meet some of the real needs, there, it's not just a heart that's open to fulfilling them, but it's the resources. The apostles we see in the New Testament, at least the first four of them, were all fishermen. Peter was an entrepreneur. It might be one of the characteristics why the Lord chose him to be the first among the apostles, precisely because of all these qualities in the entrepreneur we've already talked about. It's clearly Jesus is calling us all, no matter what our vocation, to service, telling us that he wants our ambition to be the servant of all, just like the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life, to save others from slavery. But the biggest and the most important passage, if we're talking about the entrepreneurial vocation in sacred scripture, is the parable of the talents from Matthew 25, which I presume most of you know by heart, but we'll just go quickly through it for the Catholics here. Okay. Just kidding. A man going on a journey summoned his slaves and entrusted his property to them. To one he gave 5 talents, a talent with 6,000 days' wages. So he gave 30,000 days' wages. 100 years' worth of work. Just you figure what salary you want to pay and multiply it. A lot of dough. Another he gave 2, a third he gave 1. He went off. And he told them to trade with them. The one who had received 5 talents went off and at once traded with them and made 5 more. The one who had 2 made 2 more. But the one who had received the 1 talent went off and dug a hole in the ground and hid his master's money. After a long time, think about all the time that it takes to get to the second coming of the master. He came and settled accounts with them. The one who had received the 5 talents came forward bringing 5 more. Saying, Master, you handed me 5. I've made 5 more. Well done, good and trustworthy servant. You've been trustworthy in little things. I will put you in charge of great things. Enter into the joy of your master. One who had 2 made another 2. Heard the same words. The one who had received the 1 talent also came forward saying, Master, I knew you were a harsh man, reaping what you didn't sow, gathering what you didn't scatter. So I was afraid, and I went and hid your talent in the ground. Here, have back what is yours. But the master replied, you wicked and lazy servant. You knew that I didn't reap where I did not sow and gather where I did not scatter. You ought to have invested my money with the bankers, and on my return I at least would have received what was my own with interest. So take the talent from him, give it to the one with the 10. For to all who have more, more will be given. All who have more will be given, and they will have an abundance. But from those who have nothing, even what they have will be taken away. What do we see here? Several elements. The entrepreneur is the one who, like the one with the 5 and the 2, invests what the master has given. Talent of his life, talent of his know-how, talent of his work, talent of the resource he has, talent of the opportunities. That what God has given is for creation, to create more wealth. And wealth isn't just looked at in a monetary way. It's to increase. Christian businessman, the one with the entrepreneurial vocation, is one who always remembers that the wealth is his master's, his God's, and uses it not for his own aggrandizement, but for God's. Certainly not immoral to profit from resources, wit, and labor. What was the essential problem with the servant who put his talent into the ground? At the biblical mentality, that was the bank. If somebody had entrusted you money and you immediately buried it, and somebody stole it,
you wouldn't be held responsible. If you kept it, for example, in a bag and you were mugged and ripped off, you were responsible for paying it back. So in the mentality of the time, what he did was the safest thing he could do so that he wouldn't lose it. But the Lord didn't want that type of hyper-caution. The Lord wanted him to try. We don't know how the parable would have developed if Jesus continued and this guy went out with the one talent, which again, 6,000 days wages, 16 years worth of work. If he went out with this talent and lost it, but it was a good fight, how he would have been treated. Maybe he would have been treated better. But he was afraid and he didn't act. He was angered at the timidity of the servant. We see the importance here of courage in the face of an unknown future. It was rewarded in the first two. God actually blessed what they did. But the lazy servant showed what happened when he didn't work. We also see something about macroeconomics in the parable. Master went on his journey, leaving behind a total of 8 talents. When he returned, it had become 15. There's not a zero-sum game. That's the way creation's supposed to be. We inherit, and we're supposed to make it grow. If the rich had become rich by hurting others, obviously Jesus wouldn't have praised them in the parable. But they were able to help others precisely through their work and build up the kingdom. We also see here a beautiful image of subsidiarity. That the master wasn't going to do it all himself. He entrusted his goods to the genuine freedom and creativity of the stewards. And it paid off. And that is what God does with each of us. Those who have received the talents of the Lord are meant to become co-entrepreneurs with the biggest business of them all. With the one great and eternal boss. Co-entrepreneurs with him. Let's finish, before we get to your questions, just with some practical considerations in living the entrepreneurial vocation well. First thing is that every businessman is called to sanctity in business, to be a good steward of the master. The vocation of entrepreneurs is falsified when entrepreneurs deceive or cheat others or violate bonds of trust with their associates or their constituencies. Without guiding principles and virtuous leadership, businesses can become places where expediency overcomes justice, where power corrupts wisdom, where technical instruments are detached from human dignity, and where self-interest marginalizes the common good. Work is supposed to be a place and a setting in which three things happen, according to a recently canonized saint, St. Rosemary Ascrivá, who founded in the Catholic Church Opus Dei to help ordinary lay people in the middle of their world do God's work. He said the three activities are: in our work, we first try to sanctify our work by doing it for God as the first fruits of Abel. Second is, through the work, we try to sanctify ourselves, that agere again, that intransitive quality, that God can work out our sanctification through work done well. And the third is, we try to sanctify others through our work, which might seem a little distant at first because it doesn't seem so much like the facere, making something. But if work is done well, then you recognize we're making this for somebody else. If the person who had made this dais had made it poorly, I might be injured today. The fact that he did his work well, if he thought about the ones who for decades would be using this in his work, that is a means by which, loving them, he might be able to bring them to sanctification. But it also means, in this joint enterprise, that we're able, through our virtues, to help others start to acquire more and more of the virtues of Christ. So it's not just to be a businessman. It's like when I preach in seminaries, they say God is not merely calling you to be a priest. He's calling you to be a holy priest or no priest at all. Likewise for business people or Christian.
Second, there's clearly this aspect of stewardship, and there's an aspect of stewardship that Pope Francis in particular is calling on the world to make sure that we're good stewards of what God has given so that we're able to give it even better. That we can't be exploiters of what we have, and we can't take to our whole work a consumeristic mentality of what he calls the culture of waste, which we're just constantly throwing things away as if that doesn't matter. That's not good stewardship. Third would be a unity of life, that we don't go to work and then come home as if those are two totally different spheres. They're meant to be connected because we're called to be integral. Fragmentation in life, the split between faith and daily life, can ultimately lead to a kind of idolatry, an all too common occupational hazard in business life, in which we can, in fact, serve mammon 5 or 6 days a week and serve God one. And there's a pressure on a business leader to forget sometimes the gospel and professional activity. Sometime for short-term gain, you could cut a corner and do something immoral. But that's long-term stupid, not just in this world, but forever. Business leaders may be tempted, whether from pride, greed, or anxiety, to reduce the purpose of business solely to maximizing profit or to growing market share or solely some other economic good. In this way, the good that a market economy may do for individuals in society can be diminished or distorted. There can be this alienation in the heart of a businessman. One of the ways that alienation happens is through greed, when profit becomes the exclusive goal. Profit is like food. An organism must eat, but eating can't become the overriding purpose of existence. Likewise, profit. Consumerism. Pope Francis, in a particular way, wants to battle this cancer called consumerism that leads to our eventually using others as if they're objects. And he says, with regard to consumerism, one of the things that we need to look at is whether we're serving others' needs or just their wants. Because satisfying mere wants, consumer wants, may even be detrimental to others' good. For example, the sale of non-therapeutic drugs, porn, gambling, violent video games, and other harmful products. That there needs to be a solidarity with the poor. There's a lot of things that we can do with the gifts of creativity and the resources that we have. Isn't it great if we could use it for those who need it most? One of the things I'm actually proudest of at the United Nations, there's a lot that's off there. I don't think I have to list it. But one of the things is this worldwide focus on the Sustainable Development Goals. There are a few issues in the Sustainable Development Goals, but right there off the to end extreme poverty. 60% of people are living under $1.25 a day. Just think about that. To reduce that dramatically over the course of these next 15 years, to use all our know-how to try to bring it, to form people. What a beautiful thing that is. And they've actually gotten one of the real areas of progress of the United Nations recently is they recognize they can't do it bureaucratically. They absolutely need to involve faith-based groups who don't do it for the money, even though sometimes they're compensated. And they have to involve the private sector, because that's where innovation happens. That's where you can meet needs by the market that you're never going to do by setting up a government structure. The importance of never losing a sense of dependence on God. That we receive from God first. We can't become Pelagians in our work, thinking that we no longer need the Lord. The importance of rest. The Sabbath, for example, is not just a break from work, but it's what allows us to find the deepest meaning of work. And so, like we work hard, we need to rest, so that God can press that reset button in our relationship with Him and with others, and so that we don't lose ourselves through workaholism. Let's wrap. The vocation of the business person is a genuine human and Christian calling, Its importance in the life of the church and in the world economy can hardly be overstated. In that document from the Vatican on the vocation of the business leader, it says that Christian business leaders should be men and women of action who have demonstrated an authentic entrepreneurial spirit, one that recognizes the God-given responsibility to accept generously and faithfully the vocation of business. Such leaders are not motivated simply by wealth maximization, enlightened self-interest, or an abstract social contract, as often prescribed by economic literature and management textbooks. For these leaders, it is faith that enables them to see a much larger world, a world in which God is at work, where their individual interests and desires are not the sole driving force. In the gospel, Jesus tells us, from everyone who has much, much will be demanded. And from the one who has been entrusted with more, more will be asked. Business people have been given great resources. And the Lord is not only asking them to do great things, but wants to help them do great things. This is the vocation of the entrepreneur. Thanks for your attention.